Welcome to University Showcase. I'm Megan Kamrick. Immigrant, refugee, asylum, these are words we've been hearing a lot this year. But what are the laws around refugees in the United States and internationally? And is the U.S. following its legal obligations? Professor Jennifer Moore is an expert on refugee law and teaches it here at the University of New Mexico. Moore co-authored one of the first law school textbooks on refugee law. Prior to joining UNM in 1995, she worked with the United Nations High Commission on Refugees in West Africa and in Washington, D.C. She also did work for UNHCR in Croatia on post-conflict reconstruction, and she did a Fulbright in Tanzania teaching human rights law. Last year, she received the Sarah Bell Brown Community Service Award from UNM for her, quote, inspirational example of advocacy and social responsiveness. Jennifer, welcome to University Showcase.
Thank you, Megan. It's good to be here.
How did you get so interested in doing, you know, immigration law, refugee law?
My parents lived overseas before I was born. They lived in India and Liberia for a year each. And even though they raised all of us in the U.S., our childhood was really permeated by my parents' kind of awareness of the world and connection to people from different cultures. And so from my childhood, I was really interested in Africa. And also, I was fascinated by culture and by migration and by why people move. And do they move for adventure? Do they move for need? Do they move for safety? And so I think that theme has always been there for me, both interested in how cultures come together and how cultures are split apart. And so my work, it's kind of an odd combination because I work a lot with immigrants and refugees in the United States, but I'm also pulled to the places in the world that we think of as creating refugees. And not all people leave those places. Many people stay. And they're also working on conflict resolution. They're also working on human rights. And so I don't weave it together perfectly, but I think for my students, I want them to understand that human rights work is everywhere. You don't have to go to Africa. You don't have to go to Central America. But you do have to respond to issues of justice and injustice around you. And one way to do that that's really powerful at home in the United States is to work with immigrants because they remind us of how connected this world is.
So what makes an immigrant different from a refugee when we're talking about legal definitions?
One way to look at it is that immigrants are the broader category of people that move from one country to another. And refugees are a subset, in a way, of that bigger group of people who move, who migrate, whose motivation to leave is flight and is a need to escape from violence and persecution. So immigrants include refugees. And in many cases, it's not clear, you know, why, if whether somebody's a refugee or not by the fact that they cross a border. One way to find out is to ask them. And if they are fleeing to get to a place of safety because they have experienced the threat of incredible human rights abuses or actually the experience of such abuses, then that's what we would call a refugee. There's some more technical distinctions in particular between immigrants and those who just come to visit, you know. So immigrants are basically people that come with some openness, at least, to stay in a country. And so refugees, again, you know, have an intention to stay, but it would be for the reason of seeking safety. So there's kind of an urgency, a particular urgency about refugees' immigration, which is it's fear inspired, and it's seeking asylum or safety, protection from persecution.
Now, we as the United States are a signatory to treaties and agreements about how people seeking asylum must be treated, given what's been happening at the border this year. Are we following our obligations under those agreements?
No. I mean, there are situations in which people do get asylum, even who come and cross the border without a visa. But in all too many cases, we are preventing refugees from getting access to asylum. And you're right that there's treaties that we've signed, in particular the 1967 Protocol relating to the status of refugees, which is a updated treaty to the original International Refugee Treaty, which is the 1951 Convention on the Status of Refugees. So since 1968, when the U.S. ratified the Protocol on Refugees, we have been obligated under international law not to send people back to persecution. And that's the norm of non-refoulement, which is a really oddly universal French word for non-forcible return. And so the norm of non-refoulement is the idea that you don't send people back to the jaws of death. The notion of asylum is a little bit different. Asylum is giving durable legal status to refugees. And the odd thing under both international and U.S. law is that there is no obligation to provide asylum to refugees. There is an encouragement to do it. Countries are encouraged to give asylum to refugees in their midst. The one clear obligation, however, is that they cannot be returned to the situation of danger. So what that means is some type of protection has to be provided. And the best way to provide protection is to give people asylum. So what the U.S. has to do under international law and our own Immigration Act is that we have to give people access to apply for asylum and to seek the more durable status of asylum. And the problem is we are not doing that. We are setting multiple ways to discourage people and prevent people from having access to our asylum process. So through detention, through deportation, and through family separation, we block access to asylum. But at the same time, we also create the situation in which people are forced to return home, and that violates international law.
So what are the ramifications if we're doing that? What is the enforcement mechanism, I guess?
So no international court has jurisdiction over governments, per se, from violating the International Refugee Convention. However, the court of international public opinion is sometimes the most powerful implementation mechanism that there is. I mean, in the case of human rights, one of the most powerful ways to influence government behavior is through public opinion, is through radio education, is through popular mobilization. And so, for example, in the United States, one of the ways that the Trump administration was forced to reunify the families that it had separated through its zero tolerance policy was moms and fathers and children and students and community members saying, this is not who we are. And so within, you know, a lot of damage was done and it still hasn't been undone. But within weeks, the Trump administration committed to not only stopping the family separation policy, but actually taking the steps to reunify the families that it was able to reunify. Internationally, it's somewhat similar. When you think about apartheid, apartheid was dismantled in South Africa largely because of black South Africans in concert with white South Africans hitting the streets and saying we don't want this kind of a system.
And a huge amount of international pressure.
But the international pressure was also extremely important. And Mandela, when he was elected president, he actually thanked the solidarity community of the world for standing with black South Africans against apartheid. And so popular mobilization is really, really important. But just to switch gears a little bit, on the national level, a lot of the implementation of international law, whether it's treaty-based or customary, is through domestic legal mechanisms. So yes, the U.S. Ratified the 1967 Refugee Protocol, but we also have our own Refugee Act, which is part of our Immigration and Nationality Act, which was originally passed as an amendment to the Immigration Act in 1980. And what that act did was to take major sections of the refugee treaty and put it into domestic U.S. law. So the two most important examples would be, or maybe two or three, would be the definition of a refugee. So the definition of a refugee under U.S. law is an individual who has entered the United States who has a fear of persecution based on their race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or membership in a particular social group. So our definition of a refugee, if appropriately interpreted, if you ask me, is extremely progressive. The other two important provisions of our own refugee law that Congress passed that are also in completely in harmony with international law are the notion of non-refoulement. We call that restriction on removal, or we have called it withholding of deportation. And then there is another provision of our law which also coincides with the international treaty, which says you cannot penalize refugees for having undocumented status. And a lot of people don't realize that. We actually have a provision in the INA, I think it's section 208, which says you cannot prevent somebody from applying for asylum because they entered without authorization. So you don't have to enter at a port of entry. If you are apprehended without documents, you still have a right to apply for asylum.
It doesn't seem like we're following
that
any of those things you just laid out. I would say what we've heard in the news the last few months. So what does that mean?
We still have the courts to push back. And so, yes, there are people who have been deported or have been fathers recently reunified with their kids. I just recently read some really moving accounts by a fellow immigration professor who took a bunch of students down to the Carnes Detention Center outside of San Antonio, Texas, where she and her students were working with dads and kids from Central America who had been reunified in the last few days. And the fathers are looking at being deported. So they've been reunified so that then they can make the painful decision of whether their kids come back with them or whether they stay. Now, what would happen if they stay? They can fight their asylum claim. They may have been denied in the first instance. There's something called the credible fear interview, which is typically the first opportunity that a refugee has to say, hey, I'm frightened to go home. And if they lose, if they get a negative determination in that hearing, they can appeal that. The problem is, what is going to happen to you during the pendency of your asylum claim? You're probably going to be detained. And so in theory, if we had enough attorneys, we could fight every asylum claim. And there are armies of attorneys that have been mobilized since forever, but particularly since the Obama administration did family detention of asylum seekers as well as the Trump administration. But it takes a lot of man and woman power to represent folks who don't have a right to free representation because they, in most cases, have not been accused of a crime.
They don't have a right to an attorney, which we usually would under the Constitution, because they haven't been accused of a crime, but they're in detention.
Yes. The other crazy thing is that some asylum seekers have been accused of crimes because under the zero tolerance policy, and under another aspect of our immigration law, unlawful entry, meaning entry without a visa, is a misdemeanor. So the crazy irony is that if we had an efficient enough system, those individuals who are accused criminally of misdemeanor unlawful entry do have a right to an attorney, but only for them to confront the charge of unlawful entry.
Not to push asylum.
Not to make their asylum claim. So they have a right to an attorney for their asylum claim, but not a paid attorney. So it is just a baffling and frustrating and frankly designed system to discourage people from seeking the rights that they have under our own law.
This is University Showcase. I'm Megan Kamrick. I'm talking today with UNM Law Professor Jennifer Moore. She's an expert on refugee law and worked for the UN High Commission on Refugees in West Africa before joining UNM. Central America was racked with conflict in the 70s and 80s. How is this linked to what's happening now with so many people fleeing countries like El Salvador and Guatemala?
In the 1980s, and prior to the 1980s, the U.S. had a big role to play in the political systems in Central America. And whether you look at Guatemala and some of the generals that were responsible for massive atrocities in the highlands of Guatemala, whole language groups wiped out. Some of those generals went to the School of the Americas and learned counterinsurgency policy from U.S. trainers.
That was true of the El Salvador military
as well.
And that
was also true in El Salvador. And so when I was in law school, we actually were funding our U.S. government was funding the Salvadoran military to the tune of about $1 million a day. And so our military policy was supporting the government repression in, let's just look at El Salvador for a moment, that was causing people to flee. And those folks came to the United States. And another statistic I remember, because I was starting to do asylum work even as a law student. At Harvard, they had clinics just like they do at UNM. Asylum seekers from El Salvador were denied at the rate of 98%. And if you looked at Haitians, it was 99%. Our system was even more politicized then than now, if possible, in terms of the fact that the State Department had a particular required role in weighing in on the merits of an asylum claim.
So it didn't look very good to give people asylum from a country where you were actively supporting their government,
and
their
military. And even though the treaty that we ratified says, you know, giving asylum is not a political act, in the world that we live in, it is a political act. And so if you look at the statistics for people fleeing Poland in the 80s, where we supported the anti-government solidarity movement, which was a great movement, I think, to support in many ways, those numbers where refugees were fleeing communism rather than fleeing a government we supported are over 50%. And
yeah,
refugees from Salvador and Guatemala in particular were coming to the United States, and most of them were not getting asylum, but some of them were staying in an undocumented status. Some of those folks who, especially young people, many of whom fled forced conscription by the guerrillas and by the government in particularly El Salvador, but also in Guatemala, would do what people do who can't get jobs, who can't get access to social services. They formed groups, solidarity groups, and in some cases criminal gangs. Many of them were deported, and it's believed that MS-13 and Calle 18 and other gangs were literally exported gangs that had started in the United States. And those gangs and other criminal networks and cartels, etc., are contributing to a violent situation which manifests in multiple ways, including in creating very, very dangerous situations for women, both in their own homes and in their communities. Now folks are fleeing that sort of like circle of repression and denial of rights and are now fleeing to the United States.
It's important to remember when we're preventing people from seeking asylum, we're not following our own laws internationally and domestically.
Yes.
On refugees. Like, yes, we had a large role in creating this problem.
Yes.
So
yes,
one could say we're not following our moral responsibility.
Yes,
here.
Yes, yes. And in some ways, you know, and this is, I guess, a more hopeful way to look at it, is that there's a real tendency for national communities to recognize historically, imperfectly, but still gradually, our responsibility in light of the fact that we are part of an interconnected world. And an example of that is what happened in the 1980s after the passage of the Refugee Act, which is that huge numbers of Vietnamese refugees were accepted and integrated into U.S. society. Our willingness to accept so many Vietnamese in that post-war era was hugely out of a recognition of historical guilt and responsibility. And it is part of the push in the United States of communities like the folks of Albuquerque is, I think, a recognition of that interpersonal human interconnectedness, but also a historical responsibility, which comes from the fact that we have relationships to countries like Mexico, like Honduras, like El Salvador, like Guatemala, and we have therefore more than a disconnected responsibility to respond to the needs of people coming from those countries.
I'm curious, how do you engage your students in these issues and learning about refugee and immigration law?
What I try to do is to help students realize that they can do human rights work either abroad or at home. They can work on helping folks who don't have access to health care as a way of promoting human rights, and they can also work on helping folks without status protect their family and get access to legal protection, and they can also learn about human rights work in other countries. In terms of my own practical work with students, I've taken a couple of groups of students to do kind of community-type work around immigration. And a few years ago, when family detention was happening in Texas at two facilities around San Antonio, I took a group of students and we helped prepare moms who were then being detained with their children in Carnes to prepare for their credible fear interviews, which is the first step in the asylum process. Those kinds of experiences, whether they last a semester or a week, or their volunteer positions that students do while they're in law school, are extremely meaningful in empowering them to continue to do justice and human rights work in the future.
I know you have also been involved at the university to strengthen support services for immigrant students and dreamers. Are you still working in that area?
Yes. There's actually a really great movement on UNM campus around support for all of our at-risk students, but in particular undocumented students. We have so-called dreamers in our student body, meaning folks that got the deferred action status that Obama created by an executive order.
They were brought here as children.
They were brought here as children, and their parents came without documentation, but they have been raised in this country as Americans. And some of those students have, although their status is has been in question since Trump rescinded DACA, there's still students who benefit from DACA. But we also have other students who never had DACA status and who are undocumented. So there's a group on campus called the UNM Sanctuary Campus Working Group, which includes faculty, staff, and students who do a variety of things, raising consciousness about the plight of families, many of whom are mixed status families. They include citizens, they include DACA dreamers, and they include undocumented family members. So we raise awareness about what it's like to be a student in that situation, and also do Know Your Rights trainings for faculty and for students and staff in terms of how to deal with the danger of immigration taking custody of undocumented students or trying to detain or deport them. And so one of the things that the Sanctuary Campus Working Group does is to create a protective climate where it's clear that all faculty, all staff, and all students support all of our undocumented students and insist that our campus is a place where they can grow, develop, and thrive and prepare for their careers of service to the community that all our students are preparing for.
Well, you just returned from Uganda. What were you doing there?
So I'm writing a book about women peace builders in Sierra Leone and Uganda, who all of whom lived through the civil wars in their countries And all of them are involved in community healing in the villages in which they live. And so what I'm trying to do in the book is to translate some of these abstract notions of human rights and women's empowerment, post-conflict justice, into the way it makes sense to the women who are doing the work in their communities, many times without any financial support from the outside.
Well, Jennifer Moore, thank you so much for coming and talking with us.
Thank you, Megan.
That was Professor Jennifer Moore with the UNM Law School. Find out more information about her work at kunm.org. Now we go to our segment on University Showcase about research by UNM students and faculty that you may not know about.
Nobody's ever gonna read this!
This is Marty Adam-Smith, afternoon freeform host, in the studio with my friend Lucas Dank of the University of New Mexico Department of Linguistics, a PhD student. He's also a Greenberg Fellow. This topic that you dedicated yourself to last semester, it's about languages that are hard to learn because they contain a lot of information in one word and they form those words irregularly. Did I get that right?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, if we look at one language of this state, for example, Navajo, it presents itself as very difficult to learn for English speakers because, as you said, there's a lot of information in one word. So basically, in Navajo, you got to learn for every verb a single pattern. Not like in English. You have verbs like lift, lifted, or yell, yelled. You have a regular pattern for past tense, for example. But not for Navajo, it's more complicated, I would say.
So like Spanish as compared to English, you have a few different patterns that you have to know for the past tense, but it's certainly not different for each and every verb.
Exactly. So Spanish poses more difficulty in terms of past tenses for English speakers. But Navajo, I would say that's a complete different level.
Okay. What are the implications of this for linguistic theory?
I try to find some reasons for why there is so much complexity in these verbs, and not only in Navajo, but also the sister languages like up in Canada and Alaska have also this complexity and it persists for centuries. There is maybe a reason we can actually look at English because we do have irregular verbs in English, like sing, sang, sung instead of sing, singed. So you don't form the past tense by adding a D to sing, but it's a pattern that you gotta learn. Yeah, and then if you look at the irregulars, you see that there are some similarities, not in the meaning, but in the sound, like ring, ring, rung, which is also considered irregular, but it's the same vowel alternation like sing, sang, sung.
And sure.
It is supposed that second language learners don't pay too much attention to the sound patterns, whereas children do and therefore have not that much difficulty to learn irregular forms. And so what I'm looking is these very complex languages, if they have sound patterns that are similar. Because their words are so long in Navajo, we have the higher chance. The more letters you pronounce, the more there is a chance that these letters can form similar patterns.
Ah, okay, that's very interesting.
With other words. And that's a thing that especially children are able to do.
Well, very cool. Thank you for coming in, Lucas.
Well, it was a pleasure. Thank you.
That was Marty Adam-Smith with Lucas Dank, a PhD student in the Department of Linguistics. You can hear this and all our previous University Showcase episodes at kunm.org. I'm Megan Kamrick. Thank you for listening to University Showcase.